Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This episode of Silent Giants is brought to you by Ally. Ally, powered by Verizon locations, are developed by Verizon, the world's leading technology company, in collaboration with Ally, a membership-only community workspace for creators. Each location is a community curated powered by the emerging technologies and thought leadership of Verizon. With Ally, Verizon is bridging the gap between startup and corporation by helping the community workspace build next-level ecosystems for entrepreneurs. And now, onto my interview with Ally Willis.
So I went and I met him the next day. The group, when I walked in, was working on the hookiest intro I ever heard. I thought, please let this be what he wants me to write, because there was no way this song wasn't massive.
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music. Let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study their moves, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
Today's special guest is Ally Willis, the songwriter behind Earth, Wind & Fire's classic song, September. Ally is also the songwriter of I'll Be There For You by the Rembrandts, which became the theme song for the hit TV show, Friends. She also co-wrote the Tony and Grammy Award-winning Broadway musical, The Color Purple. And currently a major motion picture based on the musical is being produced by Steven Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, Quincy Jones, and Scott Sanders. In 2018, Ally was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. In this interview, she dials into the podcast to share her journey about growing up in Detroit during the height of the Motown era, getting her first job at Columbia Records as a copywriter, working under Clive Davis, meeting Janis Joplin a week before she died, the making of Earth, Wind & Fire September, the creation of the Friends theme song, co-writing The Color Purple, and a whole lot more. Ally is one of the most fearless and multifaceted creatives I've had the pleasure of interviewing on the show. So enough of me, let me introduce you to the Songwriters Hall of Fame inductee, the Tony Award-winning, Grammy Award-winning, Emmy-nominated songwriter, artist, and set designer, Ally Willis. Well, Ally, how are you today?
I'm actually frantic today. It's I'm in between assistants, so that's always makes it crazy for me. And my IT in this house, you know, I've got 900 terabytes in this house, so it's crazy. he leaves for a week. Tomorrow's his last day. And on top of it, I was stupid enough to tell a friend they could throw a wedding at my house.
Oh, yes. So, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, no, well, no, especially because my best reputation is my party throwing. And I never realized that it was happening in the gap when no one was working here. So, and then I've got a trillion deadlines on various projects. So,
I appreciate you being on the podcast. You've done some amazing things. And truly, I'm very excited just to even hear your voice and have the opportunity just to learn more about you and your journey.
Great. All right. Well, off we go.
Well, where did the journey start for you? Where are you from?
Well, I mean, it literally started because I was born in Detroit. And it was at the time when Motown was coming up. So that had such a tremendous influence on everyone in the city. And it was at a time when Detroit, when it started, was for really still thriving, you know, new cars all over the place. So it was an incredibly modern city to grow up in, very design oriented. And then, you know, you had a city that had its own soundtrack. So I was obsessed with Motown, and I would make my parents drive me down close to downtown, which is where the little house that was and still is Motown. And I would just sit out on the lawn, never made it in, but I would sit out on the lawn and you could watch, you know, the stars come in and out. But most importantly, you could hear the music leaking through the walls because it was just such a small little place.
Who were some of the stars that you would see come, come in and out?
The Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye. I mean, it was like the biggest stars in the, you know, pop universe, basically. So so I literally to this day, despite the fact that I write both music and lyrics, and my songs have sold over 60 million records, I still do not know how to play. Because I was just used to hearing these parts and I'd go, oh, that's a bass line. That's a drum line. That's so I still hear music that way. And, you know, hopefully I'm collaborating with someone and I enjoy collaborating more than writing alone. I don't like being tortured alone. you know, hopefully they play in a style that I'm really into. If they don't, I'm kind of dead. But, you know, I hum, I bang pencils together. Once, you know, the basics are laid down, I can plunk out little arrangement parts, but I never could memorize more than, you know, four notes in a row, like where I hear them, but I have no idea where they occur on a keyboard, you know? So it's kind of by any means necessary. I do know it's fun to write with me. I'm told that by everyone because it's like they enter a spaceship. Like they have never written with anyone who writes like me before.
I want to get back a little bit into your, you know, upbringing growing up first in Detroit. When you mentioned that you were, you know, this little girl and you were hanging out the Motown house in the front yard and seeing all these stars coming in and out. You know, yeah. I often ask, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people who've worked, you know, on major projects, just like yourself. And I often ask them, are you aware of the moment or the movement that you're witnessing or a part of?
Absolutely. Because Motown exploded. And there could be five Motown records in the top 10 at any one time. Because they were literally putting out stuff every day. It's kind of like it is now, more than the traditional record business. So I was very aware, especially once I graduated high school and I went to college. I mean, there was not a person that did not know about Motown. And I went to University of Wisconsin, which was a very... you know, half of the kids were from Wisconsin, but the other half was from all over the world, tons of New Yorkers. So, you know, no, I was totally aware at that time that I lived in the coolest place in the world.
Oh, what did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a scrap dealer, also very influential on me, though he never liked that I picked up this habit. You know, being around vintage things all the time, you know, things owned by other people. Mm. And it was a really large, it was about six blocks long, had a little railroad running through it. So I would ride the train. It had stacks of these beautiful, like 1950s and 60s cars, like piled six high. And he was one of the first two people in the United States to buy the machine that crushed cars into like coffee table size cubes.
Yeah.
So I would you know, sit in that machine and push the button and like crush Cadillacs. My mom was a school teacher. She taught first grade, but she passed away when I was 14. So, you know, I only had limited time with her, but I absolutely adored her.
At what point did you want to get into music, or did you know that music was going to be a part of your life as a profession?
No, I did not know until the second it happened. Just always loved music, passionately listened to the radio, not albums so much. I was absolutely only into singles. And but when I went to college, I majored in journalism and I had a minor in advertising because mid to late 60s advertising, the tone of it completely changed. And all of a sudden it was this very hip, humorous, just completely different than it had been all the way through. So I really wanted to be in advertising, and being in journalism really taught me to write tightly. Like, what's your point? Take no more than a few sentences to get to it and you're done. So when I graduated college, someone told me that record companies, because I loved music, I had no aspirations to write it, but they told me that record companies had advertising departments, and there were more record companies in New York, even though I always wanted to come to LA. But so I went to New York and I got a job at the biggest record company there, which was, I mean, it's now Sony, but it was Columbia Records and also Epic Records. They were part of the same thing. And I got at first the job as a secretary, but within a month I was promoted to be a junior copywriter, which meant I wrote everything from like the liner notes on the back of an album to mostly print ads. Like if something would go in Rolling Stone or like Billboard, something like that, and radio commercials. And they immediately put me with the minority acts, which at that time, black and females. And, you know, that was my favorite music anyway. So, you know, I ended up working for all these people, you know, writing things for people, not music, but the promotion, the advertising, of people I just died over. And that was everything from Sly and the Family Stone, Barbara Streisand, Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel. Some of those are white, but I would get to write for them if they did like albums of like a Christmas album that include one song from each artist.
You know, tell me about moving to New York and tell me the story of packing your bags and making the move. And where did you live when you moved to the city?
I first lived with a cousin that was there. She was right on 14th Street near Fifth Avenue. So I was kind of right in the heart of things. Then I got an apartment with three friends from college and we moved to the Upper East Side. That I was never crazy about, but it was kind of close to where the record company was, kind of close. And then when I really settled in, which would have been about a year after I got there, and my main place in New York, I was on the west side on 69th Street between Central Park West and Columbus, very close to Lincoln Center. So it felt like I was in a fancy neighborhood, but you know, I was living in the cheapest apartment in the fancy neighborhood. And then I was working with all these sophisticated music people. I mean, my boss was Clive Davis. That's, you know, who had to approve all my work. And
what was it like working with Clive?
First of all, he was so powerful and I was this lowly copywriter. So, you know, I was afraid of him, but I always got along with him. and then as the years went by, it almost became like a father-daughter relationship. Like, our relationship is not built on me being a songwriter and him cutting my songs for the label. It's really, I'm 21, he's the big boss, and we still have that relationship to this day. But I, you know, I get along with him great.
And so at this time, you're still not working, you know, or thinking of yourself as an artist or as a creative or a person who makes music.
I was becoming more and more musically obsessed, and it was stretching me way out beyond the type of music that I listened to before, because I was strictly Motown and Top 40. Then once I got there, and a lot of the artists I was working with, or just a lot of the artists who were there, were more sophisticated, more rock, like Janis Joplin. I mean, I actually did get to work with her, but she died 5 days later. But I did get in there.
Wait, what was that like?
So I only met her one time when she came through to kind of approve everything. And then she flew back to L.A. and then dropped dead. But do you know who Laura Nyro was?
No, who's Laura Nyro?
Okay, well, look, she's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Look her up.
Okay.
That's who I truly died for. And her manager was his very first client. It was his basically first thing pretty much out of college. It was David Geffen. So I would meet with Geffen, I would meet with Laura Nyro, and there would be an art director involved. And, you know, so we, more than a lot of other artists, talk conceptually about what kind of mood she wanted things to be in. But ultimately, Clive had the say. And Laura Nyro was Clive's baby. That was the artist that he protected above all other artists. So it's like she was his early Whitney Houston. Also passed away young. But that, I knew I was in the big leagues when I got Laura Nyro, because you had to be really hip to know about her. It wasn't going to be an artist that everyone knew about. And she didn't have hit records as an artist per se. She did, but she was a very, very, very early singer-songwriter, revered among songwriters, just absolutely revered. You know, that was great. My very last job, when I decided, I know I'm jumping ahead, but I'm just going to tell you because I'll forget it. When I finally quit to, because I actually got a deal on Epic. So I had to quit because it was a conflict of interest. As I was packing my stuff up, which I was very excited about, because I went from being, you know, the person writing about the artist to the person who was the artist and also writing the songs. That was 3 years after I started. I was packing up, you know, my boxes, and my boss ran in and he said, "You have to do one more. We just signed this group. They're really good. This promo, it has to go in Billboard tomorrow. You have to write it." And I wanted to be like out of there. It's like, now I'm in this higher position, you know. Plus, I don't want to promote another artist because I'm now the artist, especially on the same label. Anyway, they brought the record in. They brought the cover in. I kind of had heard of them, but not really. But it was fate that the very last group I wrote for to become a song, in order, you know, to leave and really become a songwriter, was Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Wow.
Yeah. So I have always looked at that. I mean, I look at them anyway as like this was destined from centuries back, you know. But that was like, oh my God, how could, you know, I'm leaving to become a songwriter. Boom. Here's Earth, Wind, and Fire.
You mentioned you got this deal at Epic, but when did you get introduced to becoming a songwriter, and how did that deal happen?
Well, first of all, I didn't really know anything about it. In 1972, the biggest record of the year was called Alone Again Naturally by Gilbert O'Sullivan. And it was a ballad, biggest record of the year. And I absolutely loved the song. And I was on a bus driving down Columbus Avenue, heading toward my apartment. Song would not leave my head. And I just scribbled out my own lyric to it. And which I did kind of effortlessly and was kind of shocked that everything was rhyming and phrasing the same as the song. So I didn't know how to play. I had, when I got the job at the record company, I had bought a piano. Just because all of a sudden I had a lot of music friends, people would come over and play. And I called the only person I knew, was a friend from college, who I knew how to play. I knew he knew how to play piano. And he had an afro. He was white. So I thought, okay, two good starts. and just asked him if he ever, did he want to be a songwriter? He said yes. I mean, this ended up being the only song he ever wrote. But he came over and he brought the sheet music to Never Can Say Goodbye, which at that point was out by Barry White, not Michael Jackson. And he brought the sheet music over and he turned. We decided, so it's not going to sound like that. Let's start at the end of the song and just play the chords in sequence, but backwards. Like if the last chord in the song is a G, you're going to start on a G, And I always have been able to hear a melody to anything, like anything. Like when I do write, if someone else has done the track, I don't want to hear it, like nothing. Just turn on the mic, start playing it, and off I go. So, I just started singing a melody and he gets to what was the first chord in the real song. And we had, we had a verse, we had a chorus, we had a B section. And then it was just a matter of adjusting it to the lyrics that I had, even though I was singing the lyrics because I knew what I wanted the song to be. So that became my very first song. Then the next two, I figured, well, I got a piano here. Let me, they don't even need to be chords. Let me just start plunking something out. And so really, at least for the first 10 to 15 years of my career, I would bang things out on the piano. But I never, ever could sit down and play them for anyone. Like I would have to kind of like go, okay, here are the notes in the chord. And then put my hand on the chord. But it was enough to write with. So I wrote two more songs by myself. And I took them to my actual boss that was in between Clive and me, like the head of the advertising department. And he knew it was me. He loved the songs. He said, let's take them. He thought maybe it would be easier to get on Epic than Columbia. So we took them. He took them to the head of Epic, who was a guy named Ron Alexenberg at that time, and not telling him who it was because it was a conflict of interest if I was going to be doing this. So Ron liked it. He took it to Clive, and I got a deal. So my first and only album, which was called Child Star, was literally the first 10 songs I ever wrote.
Wow.
And yeah. And very first artist ever to hear them was Bette Midler. She was friends with a bunch of my friends. She had exploded like massive in her first year was 1972. So she was the first one ever to hear the stuff. And that became like my first actual show business click. And then once I was in with her, then you start meeting artists, you start meeting songwriters. So I eventually had to quit the job because I couldn't work there promoting other artists and being an artist myself. And I actually knew I was dead because while I was still there, I would go to these weekly, you know, meetings, like what albums are coming out this week, who's going to work on what. And the month that my album was coming out, so was the first album by Billy Joel and the first album by Bruce Springsteen.
Oof.
And I sat in there. It wasn't even that I thought they were incredible. I saw what their management was like. And I thought, you know, I don't really even have a manager. And these two had sharks. Billy Joel's was his wife, Bruce Springsteen, John Landau, who stayed with them all the way through. Wait, what, John Landau, was that his name? Whoever the producer is. And these people fought, and they knew the record business, and they knew like how many units, and we need to be in this publication, this publication. And I just knew I was dead, you know. So my album, it comes out. I also had never been on stage before. All I had ever been, I played a tree in a second grade play. No lines, no movement. Yeah. Nothing, no speaking, no moving. And I was still a mess. I was so nervous on stage. I wanted to die. So I only did 4 performances. And the first gig, they booked me in front of 10,000 people, opening for a folk act. And my stuff was so black. And I spent all my time, because I'm interested in so much more than music, all my time was spent on making the costumes, building sets. I mean, no one had sets in those days. No one. No one even had a sign. Like, I was begging for a neon sign with a child star on it. And, of course, they would put no money into me whatsoever. So, 4th performance, I couldn't take it. So, I literally jumped off the front of the stage in the middle of an instrumental and walked out with the band screaming at me. And many people in my band went on to become huge. I always was able to attract like great musicians and everything and singers. So I was dropped and from the label. I knew that was a blessing in disguise because I didn't have it together as a performer.
At this time, did you know that, okay, I no longer want to be the frontal talent, or did you know that I'd rather be in the behind the scenes?
Well, first of all, I never gave up on being the frontal talent. I kept that pretty much going through the 80s, even though I was starting to do tons of other stuff. But that's still what I wanted to be. I just had no performing experiences, so knew it was impractical. And I'm jumping around a little. In the 80s, when I got my house, because I started having all these hits, and I live in the same house that I bought in 1980. It was built as a party house, and I was a party thrower. And I realized, because I would do everything for the parties that I would have loved to have done in a live show. I do everything from design the invitation. I make signs. I DJ. I build sets. I build like stupid costumes that people have to wear. I design games. I do all this stuff. And then I am on mic the entire time of my party because I don't have time to spend with individual people beyond, hey, glad you're here. So everyone, the entire party, feels like they spend the party with me because they hear every single conversation that I have, you know. So I realized in around 2011, maybe, that you are a performer. And the secret to getting on stage is not to go up as a singer-songwriter, go up as a party host. And from that moment on, I actually started to perform, and it's without question my favorite thing to do now.
You know, you made the move from New York to LA, and what inspired that move to move to LA?
Okay. The first thing I should tell you is how I got my first song cut, because that still happened in New York. And I told you, like, Bette Midler was kind of like, that was my first click. Her background group to this day is called the Harlettes. And those were my three best friends. So the day I actually found out I was dropped, one of them, Sharon Redd, who went on actually to have a big like disco career, she said, well, you shouldn't be alone. Come to this recording session with me. And I didn't want to go. You don't want to be at a recording session the day that you're dropped from ever recording again, you know. But she was adamant and said very naively, maybe who's ever session is will want to cut your song. I mean, it was like his stupidest, most naive way to go in there. And I didn't know who the session was for. I knew it was female. That's all I knew. And we walked in, and there was the singer. She took one look at me and literally ran over to me, dropped to the floor, and started bowing at my toes. It was the one person that bought my album. And it was Bonnie Raitt.
Bonnie Raitt?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And literally, I mean, we barely said hi. And she said, what are you doing here? Go home and write me a song. So I had no idea what Bonnie Raitt sounded like, but I knew she was a big deal. It was like a name that I was starting to hear a lot. And I had one friend who used to talk about her all the time. He was a songwriter. None of us had hits, you know, or anything. So we're just songwriters. But he used to talk about Bonnie Raitt. So I called him at midnight. And I was walking to the subway. And I just said, meet me at my apartment. I need to play Bonnie Raitt some songs at noon tomorrow. And he met me there. We stayed up all night. We wrote three songs. We both went back to the studio because he was a phenomenal singer. Phenomenal. Like, best ever. His name was David Lasley. And he's had a bunch of hits since then. And we sang her the song. So I got my first record that day. And what I had realized was the part of the whole thing that I loved the most doing was songwriting. Because you didn't feel the pressure. You're alone in your apartment or you're with a friend. And it was behind the scenes. So I didn't have to worry about keeping my voice in shape or what I looked like or anything. So I figured, oh, well, now it's going to roll. But of course, doesn't happen that way. So I was getting a couple songs cut a year, sometimes by a big artist, but never the single. And then I realized if I'm going to starve to death, which I was at that time, it's not going to be in the cold. I've always wanted to go to Los Angeles. And I found another friend who was a comedian who wanted to move out here. And we got a car. They were called drive-away cars, where you would get someone's car that you would drive across the country for them. So it was going to be a way to transport our stuff. And as luck would have it, they gave us a Cadillac limousine to drive cross-country. So we felt that we were stars, and we drove across the country. I had so much already in the way of collection and vintage clothing that the entire car, like, you couldn't see out the windows. It was packed to maybe 8 inches short of the ceiling. And I also had a dog who was kind of small. So the dog was wedged in between the ceiling and, you know, this teeny amount of space that was left. But we thought we were stars going across country. I had $200 not only to get across country, but to get a down payment on an apartment. And we made it. And still, you know, nothing taking off, but I started almost immediately trying to get a publishing deal because I heard you could get an advance. And where I really, really wanted to be was at A&M Records, which was the biggest record company out in L.A. They had tons of huge acts. They had like Cat Stevens. They had the Carpenters. Well, Herb Alpert owned the label. LTD, that was like coming up as a big soul group. Jeffrey Osborne. Anyway, that's where I wanted to be. But it was like, if these little companies were turning me down, which they were one by one, I have no shot at the big company. And I went to probably 20 publishers. I had one little reel-to-reel that I played everyone. And heard the same thing everywhere. These are very distinctive songs. They're very good. They're not what we're looking for. Finally, the only one left was A&M. And I had no ambition to stop songwriting, but I knew I was going to starve for a long time. And the president's name was Chuck Kay. He was like the biggest publisher in the business. And the publishing company was actually called Irving Almo, which if you look up that catalog, your hair would fly off if you saw what was in there. So he puts the reel-to-reel on. First song starts. He turns it off in the middle. I'm like, okay, I have been here 100 times before. So I'm standing up and I'm starting to gather my things. And he said to me, where are you going? And I turned around and looked at him. And he had his arm outstretched with his hand, grabs my hand, shakes it, and says, congratulations, you have a deal.
Wow.
I tear up every single time I tell that story because it was the least likely thing that ever could have happened. So my first 8 weeks there, I got 11 songs cut, all by big artists, all. And within that time was when one of my girlfriends put me with someone in Earth, Wind, and Fire. She was like an A&R. And she said, I'm really good friends with Verdeen White. Do you like Earth, Wind, and Fire? I said, are you kidding? It's like my favorite group. So I started writing with Verdeen for a couple acts he was producing. And within 2 weeks, I got a call from Maurice White, who did not ask me to write a song. He asked me to write the entire next Earth, Wind, and Fire album.
Oh. With
it was, I mean, I can't even tell you. I mean, I was at the point pretty much of eating dog food, which I really did for a while. And I get this call. It was staggering. So I went and I met him the next day. The group, when I walked in, was working on the hookiest intro I ever heard. I thought, please let this be what he wants me to write, because there was no way this song wasn't massive. And, you know, it was the intro to September.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
I started writing that with him within 5 minutes of meeting him.
When you're in the studio and you hear you know, the music for September. Is this like a oh shit moment? Like, oh man, this
No, all I heard was the first, I'd say 16 bars. It was oh shit from the minute I opened the outer door of the studio and could hear what they were playing. It was like, oh my God, you know, I could write to this in 1 second. And again, usually I wrote music and lyrics, but because I had been brought in to write with Verdina on just lyrics.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
At that point for them, again, other than Boogie Wonderland, which I co-wrote with John Lennon, we both wrote lyrics, both wrote music. I was just there as a lyricist, which was not particularly interesting to me, but it was if it was Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know. So we worked, me and Maurice worked 4 or 5 months because you're working on a trillion songs at once. You know, you're working on the new album and September at the same time. So also they were a very philosophical group. The very first question Maurice asked me was what I knew about Eastern philosophies. I literally did not know what he was talking about. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm not really into it. It was like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. So, that began, you know, it went from being completely ecstatic to completely traumatic because he gave me a list of books, spiritual books, and sent me to this. It was the only spiritual bookstore in LA, and it's like reeking of incense and all this stuff that used to freak me out. So, I got 10 books, and from the first page, had no idea what any of this was talking about. And I thought, oh my God, he wants lyrics that, you know, reflect this philosophy. Not for September though. September was supposed to be purely pop. So I studied those books, absorbed nothing, didn't know what they were talking about, but realized as soon as the records came out and then throughout my life, realized what, an incredible thing this was, because these philosophies were seeping into me. And ultimately, they just tell you how to be a good person, you know, that you need to be aware you're part of a whole. Anything you do affects the whole. It was really a philosophy of how to live a good life.
When the album comes out, you know, September's release, which is a classic, like the definition of what classic is, timeless record.
September came out before September came out a couple months before the album with all the rest of them. Usually I am not one to say, oh my God, this song is such a hit. I may love parts of it. I don't like other parts of it. I think this is stupid. I think this is brilliant. But it's rare that I just give a blanket statement of this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. But I felt that way about September. And I had been playing it secretly for some of my friends. I had an old 50s car, but I had a great radio. And we would drive around in this 1955 DeSoto, and I would blast this record. And my friends, all of whom were songwriters, died. Just, it's like, this is going to be the biggest record ever. And at the time, it was huge, but it was not the biggest record ever. It only got to number 6, I think. Number 8, I've never had a number 1 record ever. I have on other charts, but not on the Billboard pop charts. So it was huge. And I did realize as the years went by that it wasn't going away. I still always heard it on the radio. But something happened about a year ago now, a year and a half ago, that blew it into an entirely different realm where, like, the classic status you're talking about, I realized it's like White Christmas now. It is never going away. And very specifically this year, I don't know if you know about this or not, but on Spotify, the Earth, Wind, and Fire version, the original record, 40 years, because it was released 40 years ago in November, which I can't believe. 40 years later, it hopped back onto the Billboard charts. That was this last September, like starting in August. Hopped onto the hip hop charts and stayed there for something like 6 weeks and knocked Eminem out of the number 1 spot on the hip hop charts.
Wow.
And yeah, it was Chance the Rapper, Drake, Eminem, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And, you know, I've talked to them a lot at Spotify because there's all kinds of crazy things going on with September. And they said they expect that to happen every year from now on. Wow. Then it goes back to, it goes to number 1. It never went to number 1. So I had my first number 1 on a seriously significant chart 40 years after the record came out.
And how did your life change after the I Am album came out? Like, how did your life change after that?
I was well on my way, not musically. I mean, musically, people knew about me, but musically, first of all, you have a big hit. Everyone in the world wants to write with you. So I started getting over 100 songs cut a year. I was writing with literally everyone on the planet, pretty much. If the record was coming out, I was on it, especially if it was black. But I felt that the quality was going out of it real fast. I started hating writing music almost immediately after having my first hit. People were sending me tracks, assuming that I was just a lyricist. And the tracks most of the time, and not all the time, but most of the time made me miserable. Because if I had been writing it from the jump, we would have gone somewhere else at bar 5. You know, like tracks that people thought were great. I always had a pretty good nose for hits, being able to tell if something was on the mark or not. And I was writing to so many things just in order to write with huge artists. That I didn't believe in the songs at all. So I was in torture all creatively almost immediately upon having a hit. By the time that I Am album came out, I knew you're not staying a songwriter. I am bored out of my mind. Because also I felt like I was writing the same song over and over again. And as much as people would say, we love how different your songs are, like Boogie Wonderland at the time was a very different song from other songs. You know, we'll give you all the freedom in the world, just like write us a song. Like, and in that case, you know, I was doing music and lyrics. But ultimately, you'd hand them in something that you thought was kind of trend-setting, different from what was out there. But they just wanted another Boogie Wonderland.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. So I, throughout the period where I was getting the most songs cut, because there were 3 or 4 years of easily getting 100 songs cut a year, I was absolutely at my most miserable. And that ended up being the biggest blessing in disguise, because it pushed me into doing other things just to stay sane, even though I was on every album that came out, but I just didn't think they were good songs. Then I had a hit, at two big songs in Beverly Hills Cop, got a Grammy for it. Even though I was having this great career, I was having hits, I was selling a ton of art, I was art directing, production designing a ton of like MTV videos. I still felt like unless I financed something myself, and I was always broke because I always financed my own career. Unless I do it myself, where I can't make any money doing it, no one knows who I am.
So I want to get into, you know, I'll Be There for You by the Rembrandts.
Yeah. And well, that ties into exactly what I just told you.
Did you know that you were making a song for just a group, or did you know that you were making a song for a TV show?
Like, I did not want to write songs anymore. It was 1994. I was so deep into the web and technology. I did not have interest in creating a linear song anymore. So I was signed to Warner Brothers at the time. I told them for a year, I want out. And every time I said that, they would say, well, you still owe us 4 songs. Or because if you co-write, it doesn't count as a full song. And I had a quota for the first time. So it finally got down to I owed a 1/7 of a song. And they said, look, there's a TV show. It airs in a few weeks. We do not think this is going to be a hit. If you write this, that'll fulfill your 1/7 of a song. And the main producer of Friends had also been a mentor of mine. So it was someone I knew, because I had won a big film award for, because I was doing a lot of short films, and that's who they put me with. So I had known him for a few years already. And Warner Brothers TV, which Friends was, called up Warner Brothers Publishing because they wanted it all to be Warner Brothers. And this producer, Kevin Bright, said, we're looking for a quirky yet commercial writer. And anytime anyone said quirky, I would get the gig. So they said, well, how about Allie Willis? And he went, oh my God. I mean, I love her. It was just fate. One of those things. And he knew I was trying to get out of my deal. So they sent me over the music, the 45-second version, that the track, not the track to the record, but the demo track that had been done. So again, I'm only half interested, but it's a way to get out. And I wrote the lyric. We had to go back and forth a lot, you know, with the producers, and because when you write for TV, you have to. But wrote the song, got out of my deal. Never thought I would hear it again because no one thought the show was a hit, and that show exploded the second it was on the air. And a radio DJ in Nashville got so many requests for what was that song. And he had happened to tape the show. So he had the song, he had the 45-second version on tape. And he started playing it back to back for 45 minutes. And they just got so many requests. It was like, okay, we need to expand it into a record. And so the Rembrandts helped on that, you know, who cut the song. And it became, no one involved in that song wanted anything to do with it. I thought it was one of the dumbest things I ever wrote. I thought it was the whitest thing. I thought, do not let this be hit. Be ahead. It will destroy my Earth, Wind, and Fire reputation. And, you know, but it was incredible. It was the number one airplay record of the year. So for me, it was a way to leave, even though, you know, I eventually come back. But it was a way to leave, and it was perceived like I was just tossing out one last hit and then, you know, not a care in the world, when in fact I was like crawling out.
I mean, that is one home. It's like a walk-off home run in baseball.
Yeah, like no, even the Rembrandts, they only got the gig because they were the only Warner Brothers group in LA at the moment who wasn't out on tour. So they didn't want to sing anyone else's, you know, songs. So that, you know, they did it again thinking, okay, this will give us points with the label, but who the fuck cares about this? So none of us wanted to be there. And, you know, for me, it felt like the luckiest moment of my life.
You have those moments in your career where, you know, creatively you think you walk into a room and you hear September playing. You're like, oh, shit, this is great. And then you have another moment of your career.
Yeah, no, that never wears off for me. Never wears off. Plus, you can turn around and say to the waitress or wherever you are, I wrote that song, and they look at you like you're nuts. Like when I, you know, I got into the Songwriters Hall of Fame this year, and I was the first one up. I give my little speech. I walk off, and I literally bump into these two people, and all I hear is, how does anyone write September? Like, it's such a classic song. And I realize it's Usher and Jermaine Dupri.
Wow.
So it's like stuff like that. Especially for that song, more than anyone else, it's just the gift that keeps on giving, you know.
When you got the job to write the song for Friends, was there any type of information that you knew about the show going in?
They sent me the pilot, and I'm a vociferous note taker. So, you know, I'm stopping the videotape every 3 seconds and writing down, okay, Phoebe, Spacey, hippie, likes candles, like, you know, Rachel wants to get married, boy crazy, rich, you know, I wrote down everyone's characteristics. And then because I think very much like a rapper in many respects is the way I approach lyrics. They just start flowing and I'm trying to rhyme. And I wrote for the next week, probably, single spaced, it came out to 25 pages of just alternate verses, alternate choruses. Sang it to the producers, knew which ones worked, knew which ones didn't. And then eventually it got whittled down. But, you know, my research was the pilot episode.
And does that song, was there anything personal lyrically that you brought in maybe about friendships in your own personal life? Or
no, I was really trying to write about those characters. The original lyrics that I wrote were more, one line was about Monica, one line was about Ross, one line, you know, I was changing it up. And then I thought, no, you know what? This just has to be when life is falling apart. I will be there for you and you will be there for me.
No one told you life was gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you broke. Your love life's the old way. It's like you're always stuck in second gear. When it hasn't been your day, week, your month, even your year. But I'll be there for you.
So it was my same message, because most of my songs, if you look at them, start out with life is not working. And then in the chorus, it goes to, okay, what's the resolution? I never wrote one that was just kind of between me and you. I would write them more about, I have to get myself together. But verse-wise, it was kind of the same old stuff that I was writing. And then certain lines, you just get a gut feeling about. Like, I knew So No One Told You Life Was Going to Be This Way. That felt like immediately that is the opening line, no matter what. And then I had taken notes because I had talked to Kevin Bright, you know, the producer who had been my mentor, who hired me. And he was just giving me a lot of examples. And at one point he said, this is very casually, hasn't been your day. It hasn't been your week. And then he went on to say, you know, you got no job and, you know, you're broke. Your love light's falling apart. So I would write those things down and then try and turn them into lyrics. And then I remember on the third line, your job's a joke, you're broke, your love light's DOA. That I was trying to get three of his thoughts in one line. And I thought the day and the week thing, I thought that's a little trite, but I need a lot of lyrics in this line. So I, you know, I threw the, hasn't been your day, your week, your month, and I was short and I couldn't figure out what to do. And then I went, duh, year. So I was hoping that would stay in there, but I didn't know if it would. So, you know, it's just you kind of stumble on things and sometimes you have gut feelings and sometimes you're just trying to jam in there what you know you need to talk about.
How did the opportunity for you to be in The Color Purple?
One of my best friends bought the rights for it to be a musical. He's the producer to this day, Scott Sanders. He took me out to dinner in 1998, told me he got the rights. I thought, oh my God, this is my perfect way back into music, black music, coming out of the technology. But he didn't ask me to write it. He asked me to advise him on who should write it. And he gave me the name of a couple people. I said, neither one of these are right. And he said, well, it's going to be one of these two. So based on these four things I tell you I'm looking for, who's the best? So I chose one of them. I told him he wasn't going to be happy. But, you know, that was that. And then a year later, he called me up and said, you're right. I think, oh, he's going to ask me. And this time, instead of two writers, he said, I'm going to give you the name of 50 writers, and I'm going to have everyone write a spec song. So I had to approve or disapprove of the 50 writers. And he got to the name Brenda Russell, who was like one of my best friends and actually was on her way over to my house at that time to co-write a score that I, for an animated TV series that I had created. And he said, what about Brenda? I said, Brenda on her own, I think it would be too much work, but together, I think we could kill it. So what if I compete with her? And he said, fine, but no special favors. And I said, you have named 52 writers and my name is not among them. I do not expect a special favor. And then I asked if our third partner that I was writing these scores was Stephen Bray. He was known more for like a lot of Madonna stuff. And Brenda, if you don't know her credits, look her up because you're going to know every song. And so he said, fine. So the only advantage we had was that I knew who we were competing against, but they were all incredibly famous. And we, between the three of us, had worked with all of them. And we thought they're all too rich and they will resent doing a spec song. And so we need to really put time into this because they're going to turn out a song in a day, which is pretty much what they did. And the only assignment was to take the book or the movie, pick a scene, and if you were to write a song for it, what would the song be? So everyone else chose very easy, like a song you would sing in a juke joint or something. And we picked what we thought was the most complex scene in the book, that had every main character in it, everything. We wanted to show that we could orchestrate. We wanted to show that we could write for different characters. And, you know, we won. So that was that.
Wow. I mean, to be...
Yeah.
You, the accolades throughout your life of, you know, being a Grammy award-winning, Tony-nominated, Emmy-nominated creative. You know, how does that feel? You know, when you look back at all the things...
Well, yeah, it's... you did miss a couple of them. Webby, you know, for all the digital stuff, Webby Award. Getting into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, which I thought would mean nothing to me, that changed everything. This 2018, for me, was the year that I finally accepted that I was accepted, you know. You know, it means... a lot. And The Color Purple actually last year won both the Tony and the Grammy, because we came back a second time on Broadway. I consider that one the real show, not the first one. So it's just, you know, when you think people don't know who you are, or in the case of The Color Purple, I felt like, I mean, yeah, it was a hit, but it wasn't a huge hit. That I felt that people honestly, you know, knew what the musical was, they would discover it differently. And we were blessed to have this brilliant British director, John Doyle, come in. And he threw everything out. He threw out every set, every prop, every costume change, every makeup change. And it was the exact same show, but all it was a wooden stage and walls, wooden chairs, and then nothing but the song, you know, music, lyrics, characters, dialogue. And that's when people discovered what the show was. So there's something I used to always fear, but always believed it was my fate that no one would really know who I was till I was older. I didn't expect to be this old. You know, but 2018 for me was the year that it kind of broke. And 2019 looks unfucking believable, like the kind of things coming together that I always wanted to come together.
What drives you? I had the opportunity to meet a very inspiring woman by the name of Susan Rogers. Susan recorded, she was Prince's engineer in the 80s. So she recorded a lot of Purple Rain, a lot of Sign of the Times. She was Prince's engineer during his peak. And we had a great conversation on the podcast about what drives you and what drove her to continue to be great. Because I feel like there's some type of gasoline in your engine that keeps you going, keeps you creative, and keeps that fight going. Yeah. What drives you?
The need to be creative, the need to self-expression, the need to always be making something that makes me happy at the moment and has a chance to change things or change things for people or affect them in ways that will improve their life. And if we use September as an example, even though it's just the song, I have never seen that song put on where everyone's toes didn't start, their heads didn't start snapping, they're smiling, they start to laugh, they come onto an empty dance floor. I feel like that song is like medicine. It's a mood enhancer. And so if I can put that vibe out into the world, that's important to me. And if I can have fun putting it out, that's deadly important to me. I will no longer work on something where the struggle is so hard to get it, because that vibe comes across in the record. I'll no longer work with artists who don't turn me on. I used to do that 80% of my career, you know, just to get the record. So,
but on a deeper level of like what wakes you up in the morning, like there are times where you've achieved success one time. Every artist, songwriter would die for September, or would die for, you know, the Friends theme song, or would die for The Color Purple. And you could have stopped. You could have stopped and said,
"No,
you know what?
I'm incapable of stopping."
Why are you incapable of stopping?
Because when I get to do it at the level when it's really enjoyable, to me, there's no greater feeling in the world. So, you know, I'm pretty much incapable of taking vacations. I've tried. I last about a half a day. I live by visual stimulation and sonic stimulation, but mostly visual. So if I'm incapable of even looking at a pencil and not thinking that it should be arranged differently on a table. And then if you put it this way, well, then what if you put this thing here and that thing there? All of a sudden you have art as opposed to a pencil, a fork, and a glass sitting on a table. You know, I'm truly inspired by feeling artistic.
What is your life looking like now? And what do you look forward to working on in the future here in 2019?
Yeah, 2019, I'm going to work my ass off. A lot of songwriting lined up. I'm working with one artist named BD Wolf. She works deep in technology. She's got an album in outer space right now. And we're working on a disco floor that mimics the brain, the brain's response to music.
Okay.
So I've got that going on. My absolute favorite thing that I'm doing is I saw a story on CNN about 5 years ago. I've been trying to track this being, I don't say human, down for 5 years. It finally happened last month. There's a ton of press on this, not of my involvement, but there is a sea lion up in Santa Cruz that's been proven to be the very first non-human mammal who has rhythm. And she will only do it to one song, Boogie Wonderland.
Get out. So,
yeah. Look up, just write in Sea Lion, you know, like on YouTube, Sea Lion Tempo Transfers. And you'll see a video of five different rhythms, five different tempos of Boogie Wonderland. And you're not going to believe what you're looking at. Yeah. Last thing, Color Purple, the musical, is going to be produced as a movie by Steven Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, Quincy Jones, and Scott Sanders, the original producer.
Wow. So the songs that you wrote be used in the movie as well?
It's a movie of the musical. So it's all 22 songs.
Wow.
Yeah. Plus we'll write something new, because that's the only way you can qualify for an Oscar. So, and that is missing from my trove. So we're going to go for it.
Wow. Ali, first, let me tell you, as a creative, like, I just admire you for being fearless. Like, when I think about this story and when people ask me about this interview, and you are fearless. You are a fearless creative. Right. You will risk everything. For the greater cause of creativity.
Yeah. No, I will stupidly sometimes, but I wouldn't change it, you know.
No, not stupidly. And I think that's something you're brave.
No, thank you.
And I admire you, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you for being on the podcast. And
certainly if you're out in LA, let me know.
I definitely will, Ali.
That would be great.
You're the best.
All right. No, I wrote that song, actually, from Karate Kid, the original Karate Kid.
You wrote the... What?
Huh? Yeah, that That it's the song where I forget, you know, the Ralph Macchio, whoever.
Yes, yes, on the Karate Kid.
Yeah, when he has the big fight and he finally beats the bully, you're the best. So wow. I love when people say that to me because they just turn around and go, "I wrote that." So you fell right into it.
Wow, I can almost tear up right now. That's amazing. That's amazing.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Bye, Ali. Take care.
All right. Bye. You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you all so much for tuning in to another episode of Silent Giants and to our special guest, Ali Willis. This episode was mixed by Mark Bird. Be sure to check out my other show, OPP, Other People's Podcast, which highlights your favorite podcasters and the dope shows they created. I'll have the link for you in the description of this episode. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Pod bless. Till next time.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.